listen to people that send us all the time messages that they are very sad for her loss, and they are missing her, and they could not be at the memorial because of the war. Vivian will march around and will break the siege. She will do everything, you know, against this war, and she usually have this, I don't know where she bring this power from, to recruit people, and would people will follow, and this is her energy, and we
well,
certainly the peace movement in Israel Palestine.
Sama Salami, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll link to your piece in 972 magazine. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Community Radio just wrapped up our annual fall membership drive. Support from listeners like you helped us reach our goal, gain new members, and prepared us to bring you more organic, homegrown, fresh off the vine community radio. Thanks to all those who donated during this drive, and thanks to those who listened in. Stay tuned for more.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life, of your journey. Join us first and third Friday of the month from 11 to noon here on KBOO 90.7 FM and available online at kboo.fm. Consuelo is my name, and I will be glad to hear from you and reminisce about your journey. Once Upon a Time, live in the air room here at KBOO 90.7 FM. Share with us your memories, experience, and journey of your life. First and third Friday of the month from 11 to noon here at KBOO 90.7 FM.
Well, you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:02. Coming up now, it's your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley becomes the second senator to call for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Portland Public Schools and the Teachers Union are close to coming to an agreement.
And the Pentagon fails its sixth audit in a row, unable to account for billions of dollars.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 20th, 2023. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Ron Bronson. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley called for a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. Merkley is the first federal lawmaker from Oregon to call for a ceasefire, and the second U.S. senator to call for a ceasefire. Some 40 House members have called for one as well. Representative Earl Blumenauer has called for, quote, a pause in hostilities, end quote. Merkley wrote in a statement that he reached the decision after, quote, many Americans, including thousands of Oregonians, have raised their voices to say more must be done to stop the carnage, end quote. He continued, I am calling for a ceasefire, a cessation of hostilities by both sides. To endure, the ceasefire and the following negotiations must accomplish other essential objectives, including the release of all hostages and a massive influx of humanitarian aid. Over 12,000 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the conflict, including 5,000 children. 19 senators told The Independent they support a, quote, humanitarian pause in Gaza, which is with Biden, the Biden administration also has the same position. A survey from a month ago, according to the Data for Progress, found that 66% of voters supported the ceasefire, including 80% of Democrats and 56% of Republicans.
The Portland teachers' strike is yet to be resolved, but the Portland Public School Board says the sides are very close. The Portland Association of Teachers released a statement this morning saying that the sides had reached a tentative agreement, but the Portland Public School Board unanimously rejected it. They wrote, quote, This crisis of their own making unnecessarily prolongs the strike and demonstrates the inability of district leadership to govern Oregon's largest school district, end quote. PPS disputes that, though, saying there was only a, quote-unquote, conceptual proposal, not a tentative agreement. The district says the sides have agreed on 17 articles since Thursday. Those include planning time, special education, and mental health supports. They say only three articles and two appendices are still on the table. Once a tentative agreement has been reached, the PPS board will vote to approve it, and union members must vote to ratify it. Also on the table will be a quote-unquote return to work agreement that will figure out the logistics of schools resuming. PPS moved to close schools preemptively this week, so the earliest students and teachers could return to class is Monday, November 27th. Excuse me.
From Hollywood actors to auto workers to local Starbucks employees, signs of union activity are everywhere. But the actual membership numbers don't match up. Union leaders in Minnesota recently discussed some of the underlying issues and what can be done to boost growth. Mike Moen has more in St. Paul.
States like Minnesota have seen a tidal wave of union organizing amid public support to improve pay and workplace conditions. However, labor leaders acknowledge the slow growth of membership, prompting questions about the movement's future. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says nationwide the number of union jobs last year increased by nearly 2%, but the actual membership rate declined to 10.1%. In a recent University of Minnesota panel discussion, Bernie Burnham of the Minnesota AFL-CIO said the dynamics of organizing have changed, including smaller groups of employees pursuing contracts.
Like in retail, there are a lot of places that use self-checkout, so there are less workers in these stores, and they're not going the traditional route, the old-school route of joining these bigger bodies that are the bigger unions.
Despite the differences, she suggests there's a lot of energy among the newer voices. The experts added that corporations are taking a harder line on organizing, and that under most laws, it's hard to enforce anti-union messaging. Minnesota recently bolstered its laws, but some panelists noted most workers today don't come from a union household and could use more education and awareness. Kathy McGarry, who helps lead labor relations with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, suggests there are workers who want to see more value in the dues that are required.
I have seen unions make actual political changes in terms of how they service their members. Put more money towards organizing, less money towards servicing their members. That's a strategy, but then when you're not servicing your members well, I've seen that hurt some unions, not all.
She says that can be a hindrance for workers who sympathize with the cause but aren't ready to sign up for a union. Meanwhile, the panelists see hope for more diversity within organized labor amid a shift from older white males leading organizing efforts. They say having more women and people of color taking charge can potentially help with recruitment. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
The United States Department of Defense has once again failed its Congress-mandated annual audit. This marks the sixth year straight since the Pentagon launched its first independent financial audit in 2017. The Pentagon, with its near trillion-dollar budget, is the largest of any federal government agency. The auditing process requires 24 standalone audits, along with a consolidated audit conducted by the Pentagon Inspector General in tandem with independent public accounting firms. Their work is sizable, with the department totaling $3.8 trillion in assets and $4 trillion in liabilities. Each audit has resulted in a quote-unquote disclaimer of opinion, which means the auditor lacked enough records to accurately assess. The department insists its most recent audit illustrates growth. This despite the Pentagon failing as many of its sub-audits as last year, with the number of disclaimers actually increasing. Pushing back against these claims, Pentagon Comptroller Michael McCord said in a press briefing, quote, "We still believe that we have seen signs of progress that are going to get us more favorable in the future," end quote. Former Comptroller Thomas Harker had publicly set a 2027 deadline for a clean audit of the department 3 years ago. According to Julia Gledhill of the Project on Government Oversight's Center for Defense Information, the department has since distanced itself from that time frame. Questions of the Pentagon's financial mismanagement have not halted increases to the department's budget. President Biden has requested a record $886 billion for the department for next year, with House Republicans hoping to add $80 billion to this figure. Earlier this year, a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers led by Senator Bernie Sanders reintroduced the Audit the Pentagon Act. If passed, the act would force every part of the Pentagon, which fails an audit, to return 1% of its budget to the Treasury.
Portland's Hollywood Library was closed on Sunday after a protest against the group planning to use one of the library's public meeting rooms. The group is called Women's Declaration International USA, which describes itself as a feminist group focused on, quote, the sex-based rights of women and girls, unquote. Critics of the group say they are transphobic and their members are TERFs, or trans-exclusionary radical feminists. Over the weekend, graffiti was sprayed on the library's walls with messages saying, TERFs out of PDX, among others. Dozens of protesters carried signs outside the library on Sunday. The Women's Declaration International group decided to hold their activity outside the library and not in a meeting room after talking to library security and the PPB. Multnomah County Library posted a statement on their website about the event and the closure. It read, quote, in accommodating such uses, Multnomah County Library supports and endorses the American Library Association's Library Bill of Rights. That document includes the principle, libraries which make the exhibit spaces and meeting rooms available to the public they serve should make such facilities available on an equitable basis, regardless of the beliefs or affiliations of individuals or groups requesting their use, unquote. The library is back to normal operations this week.
Veterans say reducing dependence on foreign sources of energy through the Inflation Reduction Act will improve national security. The 2022 law invests $370 billion in clean energy. Eric Tagedoff has more.
A group of veterans is touting the national security benefits of the Inflation Reduction Act. The organization Elected Officials to Protect America says the law, passed by Congress in 2022, will decrease the country's dependence on foreign sources of energy with a $370 billion investment in clean energy. Army veteran and Beaverton Mayor Lacey Beattie says in wake of the region's devastating wildfires and heat dome, she helped push for protections for renters in Oregon.
Well, I'm very proud of that legislation. I'm very proud that the governor signed it, and I was very proud to build the coalition to do it. Imagine what a tenacious mayor could have done if I wasn't focusing on climate-related emergencies. Like, we could have been building more pipes and schools and infrastructure and bridges.
Beattie says the recent disasters in the state have underscored the importance of taking action on climate change. Alex Cornell Dehu is a Marine vet and former Maine State Representative. He's also president and co-founder of Elected Officials to Protect America. He points to the conflict in Ukraine as evidence of the importance of energy independence.
With the Inflation Reduction Act, it is part of the solution to decouple ourselves from this dependency on the source of energy in which autocratic nations primarily control. And that's the exciting thing about it. It's an amazing solution that's really tangible and a historic investment.
B says mayors like her will ensure funds from the Inflation Reduction Act go to places that do the most good to fight climate change.
We can be trusted by the president to deliver on the ground. So that's why you see so many mayors excited about the Inflation Reduction Act, because we know how to put money to work right away.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. is reportedly close to securing the release of some Hamas hostages. Ceasefire protesters shut down the Democratic Party convention in California. And a judge says North Dakota illegally diluted the voting strength of Native Americans. With these stories and more, it's Kathleen Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I have a high degree of confidence that Americans will be involved. There are nine of them, but Americans' involvement will be an imperative, I think, for the president, rightly so.
Democratic Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal tells NBC the U.S., Israel, and Hamas are near a deal to release Americans and others taken hostage last month. The rumored Qatar-brokered deal for 50 of the 240 held could come in exchange for a pause in fighting. Activists nationwide continue to push President Joe Biden and his party to call for an immediate ceasefire. More than 2,000 protesters shut down the California State Democratic Convention in Sacramento Saturday.
We will not vote. Give our money to any elected official who does not say ceasefire now.
The cancellation overshadowed endorsing a candidate to replace the late Senator Dianne Feinstein in the March primary. Representatives Adam Schiff and Katie Porter oppose a ceasefire. Representative Barbara Lee supports one and won the convention vote, narrowly beating Schiff. Fulfilling a promise to his far-right members, House Speaker Mike Johnson says he'll release thousands of hours of footage from the January 6th Capitol attack.
We are trying to hold you up with this now. We need to hold the doors of the Capitol.
More than 40,000 hours will gradually be posted on a House website. Johnson says it'll let Americans see for themselves what happened. A federal judge says North Dakota's legislative redistricting violates the Voting Rights Act by breaking up the power of the Native American vote. Turtle Mountain Chippewa Chairman Jamie Azor tells KFYR-TV the ruling's a major win for tribal nations.
It may seem like a simple redistricting case, but it's just an example of nations coming together to challenge when we feel wronged.
North Dakota lawmakers have until just before Christmas to draw new maps. At least 30 federal lawsuits across the country challenge legislative districts. Massachusetts voting rights groups say last year, two-thirds of provisional ballots, often from low-income Black and Latinx voters, were rejected for technical flaws. Cheryl Clyborne Crawford with Mass Vote says under same-day voter registration, election officials could clear much of that up.
Instead of turning people away, which discourages voters, it would encourage and empower voters.
Washington, D.C. and half of the states allow same-day registration. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has died at the age of 96. Carter was known as a staunch advocate for mental health and the elderly. Beloved wife of former President Jimmy Carter, Rosalynn visited more than 100 countries, built houses with Habitat for Humanity, and promoted public health and democracy across the developing world.
There's so many opportunities, and if I don't use the influence I have to help those people who need help, I think that's a terrible waste.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, Highway Robbery, how a small town traffic trap became a legal black hole. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30 p.m., it's Prison Pipeline. And then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 38 degrees and wind gusts up to 18 miles an hour. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy, with a high of 55. Today in history, in 1969, Native American activists seized control of Alcatraz Island until being ousted by the U.S. government in June of 1971. And our quote of the day is from English ballerina Margot Fonteyn, who said, quote, "The one important thing I have learned over the years is the difference between taking one's work seriously and taking oneself seriously. The first is imperative, and the second is disastrous."
The new president of the National Congress of American Indians was sworn in on Friday as the convention delegates voted down controversial proposals. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Congress of American Indians has new leaders, including President Pechanga Tribal Chair Mark Macaro. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
New NCAI President Mark Macaro was officially sworn in with other leadership positions Friday as the organization's annual convention wrapped up in New Orleans. Macaro says his priorities as president will include being more vocal in Washington, D.C. He also says there needs to be healing with state-recognized tribes upset with this year's membership amendment vote that would have stripped them of their voting rights and leadership positions at the organization.
I want to get all of us used to coming to D.C. to re-engage in an even better way. The mission of NCI, which is being present in D.C. to Congress, the administration, and the White House to advocate priority issues.
Outgoing NCI President Fawn Sharp reflected on some of her greatest contributions as NCAI president.
Continuing to advance tribal sovereignty in the face of a myriad of challenges, including just 3 months after my election, a global pandemic and disproportionate funding that left us vulnerable. And we achieved equity with state local government. I think that laid a foundation for our advancements in the tax policy arena. So I was the first tribal leader to receive diplomatic recognition to join the U.S. delegation to COP 26 and 27 in Scotland and Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. And the U.S. looked to us to lead a high-level multilateral conversation between the United States directly with indigenous leaders from every continent.
Sharp says she'll continue to work to make an international imprint as she works to get tribal nations more visible outside of the United States by attending a meeting with indigenous leaders in Dubai as Macaro starts his term as president. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
As part of Native American Heritage Month, the American Bar Association recently asked a group of Native women to talk about how they became lawyers and trailblazers. The panel included U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland and Alaska's former Lieutenant Governor Valerie Davidson. KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports.
There was a common thread among the women, a strong desire to serve their people, along with encouragement from elders, especially aunties and grandmas, which helped them fight loneliness and isolation during a time when there weren't other Native women, let alone other Natives, in law school.
Thank you for your dedication to this profession.
For Secretary Haaland, her journey to law school began when she was 28 as a single mom who worked to put herself through law school and occasionally had to turn to food stamps. She told the group she's happy to see more Native women in law, but says progress comes amid somber reminders from the marginalization of Native Americans to the chronic neglect of missing, murdered, and indigenous people.
The MMIP crisis will take the brilliance of legal minds like yours to overcome the jurisdictional challenges that make it difficult to address.
Long before Valerie Davidson served as Alaska's lieutenant governor, she saw the law as a powerful political tool. Davidson, now president and CEO of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, says a law degree gave her a seat at the table as a decision maker and a game changer.
Not only being at the table, but designing a different table that is more inclusive.
Inclusion for Abby Abinanti means elevating tribal courts. Abinanti, the chief tribal judge for the Yurok tribe in California, says they're needed because the state court system is based on individual rights.
We were a responsibility-based culture. That's a different value system. And so our practices should look different.
And that difference, she says, brings diversity to the legal system. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Many people caring for children and aging parents are struggling to figure out how to save for long-term care when they retire. The WA Cares Fund helps people save automatically from their paychecks for this care. Eric Tagadoff has the details in Washington.
Washingtonians with kids and older parents in need of care are praising the peace of mind the state's new retirement savings program is providing them. Working, middle-aged people caring for kids and their parents are considered members of the sandwich generation. The WA Cares Fund will provide benefits so that people can pay for long-term care. Kristen Hyde says her father needs at-home care and would have benefited from the fund. She worries that without the fund, her pre-existing condition would have kept her from receiving coverage.
I even make a decent income, but I know that as a working mom with a kid in college, it's really impossible for me to set aside tens of thousands of dollars into a safety nest egg in case I need care someday.
Starting in 2026, Washingtonians will have access to up to $36,500 in benefits from the WA Cares Fund. Workers start automatically contributing a little more than a half of 1% of their paychecks into the fund in July 2023. Rivka Burstein Stern has two children and her parents live with her. She says she's lucky that her parents are able to support themselves.
It is scary to think how financially ruinous it can be if there's not support to give them the care that they need.
Dana Barnett has a child and parents who don't yet need care, but she says it's stressful to think about, and she's thankful the WA Cares Fund will one day help her.
I can just imagine it being so helpful, and it gives me a sense of relief just thinking about it being out there for myself and also for others in my community.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, or ODFW, announced that the Dungeness crab season will be delayed from December 1st to December 16th. They say that preseason testing showed that crabs were too low on meat yield in some areas. Last year saw a six-week delay in the crabbing season due to a low meat yield and elevated levels of domoic acid, a naturally occurring biotoxin. The 2022-23 season landed over 31.5 million pounds of land and generate an ex-vessel value of $85 million. The ex-vessel value of crab is the price per pound at the site of first purchase multiplied by the total pounds caught. The ODFW will conduct further crab meat yields and biotoxin testing in the weeks to come. Washington and California coordinated their crab testing in the opening of their respective commercial seasons, with Oregon have made the decision to also push back to December 16th.
A Prineville, Oregon company had their first successful test flight of a flying car called Switchblade. The company is called Samson Sky, and they've been working on a flying car for the past 15 years. They're not the first to do it, but they are the first to build a two-seater. Within 3 minutes, it can transition from driving mode into flying mode, with the wings and tail unfolding like a switchblade. Earlier this month, the car completed a successful six-minute test flight 500 feet off the ground. Sam Bousfield is the CEO and designer of the Switchblade. He told KGW, quote, "With this kind of vehicle, you're never stopped. You can drive underneath poor weather, or take and fly above construction delays, or just boring scenery when you want to get somewhere fast," end quote. It's in high demand, too. Already there are some 2,300 reservations from all 50 states and more than 50 countries. People would need both a driver's license and a pilot's license to operate the experimental vehicle. Production is expected to start in 2 years.
New research links climate change impacts to depression in high schoolers. Suzanne Potter spoke with researchers to learn more.
New research says natural disasters and pollution linked to climate change are contributing factors to high rates of anxiety and depression among young people. Researchers from San Francisco-based Hope Lab consulted experts and interviewed youth climate activists to determine how climate impacts, like wildfire, extreme heat, drought, flooding, and air pollution, are affecting young people's mental health. Dr. Emma Bruhlman-Senecal is research lead at Hope Lab and the author of the Climate Generation blog.
We are focusing on climate change because Hope Lab's mission is to support the mental well-being of young people, particularly those from communities that have been underinvested in. And it's clear that climate change is deeply impacting youth mental health, particularly the well-being of youth of color.
Hope Lab's findings recommend more funding for youth-led activism, but they also recommend making mental health services more accessible by locating them in places where young people spend time, such as schools and community centers. Another Bay Area nonprofit, Youth Truth, paired up with the Sonoma County Office of Education to survey students over the past 8 years. The county's Youth Truth lead, Jessica Progulski, says after 2017, when thousands of homes burned down in a series of wildfires, reports of depression and anxiety shot up.
Some of the early research around resiliency indicates that the ability to do something about it as a student has the potential to offset some of the later health risks associated with childhood adversity in spite of climate change and climate anxiety and dread that comes with it.
So the Community Foundation of Sonoma County launched the Environmental Justice Coalition, which partners groups of students with a mentor to work on local environmental issues. Jimmy Simpson, director of partnerships with Youth Truth, says the disruption of the wildfires, followed by COVID, took a toll early on.
There was a definite correlation between students significantly impacted relating to less positive perceptions around engagement in school, as well as their sense of belonging and academics.
More recent surveys show while the immediate impact of the firestorm has lessened, episodes of anxiety and depression continue to affect school performance. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You have been listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 20th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson, the producer, engineer, and director of our show tonight, Althea Bellings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Carthen Carley, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, and Anthony Lazowitz. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO on KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Ron Bronson.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact.
Making contact.
Welcome to Making Contact. I'm Anita Johnson. This week, we bring you a story from our podcast partners, 70 Million. About 20 minutes north of Birmingham, Alabama, on Interstate 22, is the working-class town of Brookside. Its 1,300 residents make it about the size of a large high school. According to the 2020 census, Brookside's population is mostly white. 21% are Black. Fewer than 100 of its residents are college graduates. On paper, it's a lot like other small towns in this part of Alabama. That is, until 2022, when Brookside became infamous for all things a traffic trap. The sheer scale of the trap, the type of tickets issued by Brookside police for driving in the left lane, for example, and the nature of the interactions motorists reported having with police caused outrage among residents and caught the attention of a reporter named John Archibald.
Brookside in 2018, for example, was making $82,000 in fines and fees. And 2 years later, that number reached $610,000.
In Brookside, several lawsuits are pending, including one from Sarah Harris, who says she feared for her life during an interaction with a police officer.
I still think about it. I still relive it. Sometimes I go in my little space area and I just cry out to God, what did I do to get to be treated like this?
Reporter, running a tour, takes us to Brookside, Alabama, where drivers who were caught up in this dragnet are speaking out about their experiences.
I love law enforcement. I don't have anything but good things. Never been afraid until I hit Brookside.
During two emotional town halls in February 2022, about 200